I've been thinking a lot about, many of the writers talk about gender in Black communities. And so even that conversation pushes against, I think, our tendency to read sensibilities of a time period in a simplistic way. That so much, like, sort of, people did this in this period and people thought this in this period. And there's actually a wide range of the ways that people were experiencing, even in the midst of the sort of blooming of Black women's literature, what people were experiencing it as substantively varied.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of our live event series. Haymarket Books is a radical, independent publisher dedicated to connecting social movements with the ideas they need in the struggle for a better world. You can help support the Haymarket Project by buying books at haymarketbooks.org and especially by joining the Haymarket Book Club. By joining the book club, you get all new Haymarket titles delivered to your door and a 50% discount on the entire Haymarket website, all for one low price. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and the Haymarket YouTube channel to access all of our upcoming events. If you really want to help us out, rate and review the podcast on Apple or whatever platform you're listening on.
Hi, good evening, Imani. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very, very good. I'm really excited to talk with you about Black Women Writers at Work. I know it's a book that both of us really, really enjoy and are really excited about this reprint that's finally back in print after so many years from Haymarket Books.
I am as well. And I, part of what I love about the timing of this is that last week you published that gorgeous piece about the sisterhood, writing group. I think in some ways, because both of us are attentive both to sort of the legacies of Black women's writing and also Black women's history, that the sort of the combination of those two things are so present in this book. They're writers who are historically concerned, and it's now also a historical artifact. So, I'm really excited to be in conversation with you.
Yes. I wanted to start with asking, when did you first encounter this book?
Such a good question, and I don't remember. I mean, it was a long time ago. I didn't know Claudia Tate well, but I knew her some. From sort of like the world of Black women scholars of the 19th century. And I was a 19th century person when I came through graduate school. And so I, read all of her. I mean, I read her book about 19th century literature, Domestic Allegories of Political Desire, really, really carefully as a scholar. And then this book, I guess in the 90s, right? But this book was the book that was sort of more the heart book, in the sense that this is really about, I felt like, a testimony to what it meant to sort of live in the world of writing and ideas and, while holding like close to the truth of what it means to be a Black woman. What about you?
I heard about this book from a fantastic writer named Jamie Hatley, who's a really beautiful fiction writer and also writes for, I believe she writes for P-Valley now. I had gone to a writing conference with her. I went to Breadloaf with her, which is, if you're sort of unfamiliar with that space, it's sort of like a very... I don't know that they would think of it this of themselves, but people perceive it as a very sort of like gatekeeping space for literary writers. And we were there, and Breadloaf, I think at that time when we were there, was sort of going through a transition of figuring out how to become a space for all writers, including Black writers. While we were there, we talked a lot about all this stuff, and she was really sort of like passing this, I don't know if it was while we were there or maybe afterwards, she was like, you need to read this book. You have to get this book. Because at that time, this was probably 13 years ago now. sort of all the conversations that are happening right now in literary circles about like craft in terms of writing about the interiority of Black women, like those conversations were happening, but they were happening interpersonal in between ourselves. And there was like a real hunger for books that spoke to that craft question. Because I think a lot of us were experiencing being in either grad school or in writing groups, like predominantly white writing spaces, and oftentimes the work of Black writers sort of being assigned, Toni Morrison has that great phrase where she talks about it being like assigned as like broccoli, like here's the thing, here, take it, like just read it, you say you need a Black person, here you go. We're not going to look at this in terms of like a piece of art, we're not going to look at terms of it as pieces like part of a longer tradition, it's just here it is, dropped on the syllabus for you. We're only going to talk about it in a certain way, and we're not going to talk about like the artistic choices that this person made, and that this person was an actual artist forming it, and sort of like the subtext being like, when Black women write, it's somehow coming from this space that is not mediated through craft or history or conversation or anything. It's just sort of like dropped down like an alien. And knowing that that couldn't possibly be true, we were sort of like all really hungry to find these texts where we could trace the actual craft that these women were doing, like how these women thought about language, how they thought about storytelling, how they thought about plot, how they thought about, and then, you know, Claudia Tate is such a brilliant interviewer. She's also asking about how do you think about writing community? And this question that is paramount to Black writers of all genders is like, what do you owe, or what are your community ties in your work? And she asks them that very plainly, and people, and they answer in sort of like very great detail. So all of those questions that were animating so much of our work, and that I think if you're, are continual questions that come up whenever you're writing something, but definitely when you first like are tackling a project, feel really pressing, felt like there were guideposts in this book to sort of at least spur thinking about it. And for me, this book has been so important because I think another thing that often happens if you are a Black, especially Black fiction writing, is it's really easy to fall into the fallacy that like, because you haven't seen it before, no other Black writer before you has been thinking or feeling or talking about these things. And the larger, I think, publishing world actually rewards you for saying that, right? Like, sure. It's easier to believe that than to sort of say, like, people have been talking about this for years and years and have been actively shut out of, like, that discussion going further. So for me, this book is actually really valuable because it reminds me that so many of the questions and debates that we have currently are part of an ongoing conversation that's been going on for, at this point, like almost 200 years in terms of Black writers in this country. And that's actually something really rich that this is a verdant ground where you can have a 200-year-long conversation about these questions.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's where I found the book. And when I came to the book, it had been out of print for many years, so you had to buy, like, really search for it. I think a copy cost like $45 or something, like $50, sometimes $75. It really took a lot to find them, which is another reason why I'm so happy that this is in print again and like accessible in a really real way for people.
I think that's it's so absolutely true. Do you have a one or two essays that particularly resonate for you in the volume, or interviews, conversations?
Yeah, I mean, I'm super basic, so the ones that I always come back to are the Tonys, Toni Morrison and Toni Kade Bambara, the Toni Morrison one in particular, like I come back to the passage where she talks about the type of language that she's using, because I feel like that's really important for me as well. She calls it parabolic language. So she's talking about choosing to use words that have fallen into cliche, words that we assume we all know the meaning of, like words like love or peace or happiness. And that her job as a writer is to construct a sentence and place that word in the sentence in a way that the reader is tripped up and finds that word anew, and that word, they're forced to reconsider how they would define that word. And so for me, that's like super, when I first read that as a like writer starting out, that was just revelatory, you know, because it's like, what do I actually have to work with? Like, you know, there's a school of writing fiction where you sort of like go for the most obscure, most crazy phrase possible. And that can be very beautiful, you know, like when you're reading a book and you're like, I have to stop and like look up a word and kind of like figure it out. But it made me sort of rethink like what I'm actually doing on the page to set a challenge like that, to set a challenge like that around a word that people assume they know the meaning of, and having and writing in such a way that would force, not force, but invite a reader to rethink the definition. Mm-hmm. I just really love that.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. I mean, it's interesting because one of the, going back to something you said just a few moments ago, is this thing for me, this formulation that Nikki Giovanni has about experience and Black writers and the question of craft. And she has this paragraph on page 94 where she says of the new edition, she says, you know, about the assumption that Black women's writing and writing generally comes from experience. And she says, you know, Intozake is naked on that stage, but not because she's writing from experience. I resent people who say writers write from experience. Writers don't write from experience, though many are hesitant to admit that they don't. I want to be very clear about this. If you wrote from experience, you'd get maybe one book, maybe three poems. Writers write from empathy. We can't get anything written when we consider it an experience, right? Because if it's in someone else's experience, we don't have to take it seriously. We really don't. We could say, that's what happened to Intozake. Isn't that a shame? That's not what happened to Intozake. I don't know whether it did or it didn't. That's not the point. The point is that's what happened. That's what still happens. For me, this resonates so deeply because there's a way in which what you're describing, the way that people reduce Black women's writing so often to this sort of representation of experience as opposed to a grappling with the truth of the world and the truth of history and the truth of, right, is both finds its way into craft, but also into the sort of philosophical disposition relationship to the work of writing. And I think, you know, it's one of these many gems throughout the book where there isn't this avoidance of the embodied experience of being Black women. And there's also refusal of a reduction of that experience to something less than profound, less mm-hmm. than, you know, complex, less than, you know, nuanced. I mean, there's also, you know, I love the sort of movement between the particularities of life, right? So they talk, you know, and the serious work of writing. So also in the Toni essay, when they say, you know, where do you find time? And she was like, well, you know, I don't go out that much. I don't do a lot of stuff. And I was like, oh, okay, that feels really familiar, right? Like, you know, sort of there's moments where or there's a moment when Maya Angelou is like, you know, oh, you know, give up this posture of like, oh, I'm this long-suffering writer. You know, you do everything in life. You make love, you know, you cook some food, you take care of kids, and you write, right? And I think there's that, like the very real experience. And then there's also these serious, rigorous thoughts about craft, about ideas.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's such a, I just really appreciate how much Claudia Tate, you can see sort of like, I guess I think about it a lot because I do a lot of interviews in my day job, and I think about what a difficult job it is often, because you are having to like really listen to understand the conversation and to let the conversation go where you discover something new instead of like just following a particular agenda or what you thought when you were coming into the conversation. So I'm just also always, when I read it, I'm in awe of Tate's sort of like questioning and her following the intent of each of these authors, and the space that she makes for each of these authors to really like define themselves, I guess, in a way that sometimes when you're reading interviews with artists, they're not always allowed to, because the interviewer sort of has like their own agenda or their own idea of what the work is. And I think that's sort of like another like on a sort of like meta level of what this book is too. I think it's a really wonderful piece if you are interested in critical writing, as particularly like arts critical writing. It's a wonderful template and understanding of like how to do that work, how to be an art critic, how to have those conversations about art and creation. That I think it's a dying art. I don't think a lot of people know how to do it anymore. So it's really fascinating to me to see Tate's questions on the page and how she shapes the interview sort of in response to what people are saying to her.
Do you think that you're absolutely right, and I hadn't actually thought about that. Do you think that it's because it's a kind of respect for the writers that allows that? I'm really intrigued by what it is that allows that Tate sort of had in terms of her disposition to allow the space to open, but also that they trust her.
Yeah.
You know.
I think it's her, probably, to me, like off the top of my head, I think it's her training as a literary scholar. And I think it's when you are a literary scholar, you're working literally with what's on the page. You can't really deviate from that, right? Like, you have to work with the words on the page. You can't work on like what you assume somebody says, or like the vibes of the room, or like what you hope somebody meant by something. Like, you're working literally with what the words on the page are and what those words, those people chose, not what you hope they chose or what you think they should have chosen and said or anything like that. So I think because she's coming from that perspective, whereas I think we're in a current moment where we're kind of at a crisis in terms of how to talk about art. And that it's oftentimes people are talking about what they wish something could have been, yes, or who they wish an artist could have been, and not actually who that person was or right, what they actually produced. And, you know, sometimes it's pillaring people from the past for not doing the things that we really wish they had were doing right now. And other times it's like grossly misreading an act or event or action in an artist's life, because you want it to have meant something that maybe it did not mean to the artist at all.
Right. No, I think that's absolutely right. And that it extends to a refusal to take a work on its own.
Mm-hmm.
Terms, right. I mean, that's the thing that, you know, they have set, like, I'm really interested in, you know, there's people who she's interviewing who are in some ways not necessarily at odds, but like, the Margaret Walker interview and the Gwendolyn Brooks interview, where Margaret Walker was experiencing some wounds about feeling overlooked in relationship to Gwendolyn Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of folks. I mean, you know, I think that in some ways that's a key part of her story. And I'm really looking forward to a biography of her that should be coming out later this year, next year.
Of Gwendolyn Brooks or Margaret Walker?
Margaret Walker.
Okay.
From Mary McGram. But there's a way that even that could have been played very differently by someone who wasn't inclined in the way that you described to paying attention to what's on the page, to asking the questions about what the particular artist was sort of putting together and you can see that there's a kind of, that they're contemporaries and they're trying to do some similar things with form and the politics of blackness and have similar intellectual genealogies and are in crossroads and comparable communities. And that's one kind of relationship. And then you have, you know, Toni Morrison and Toni Cade, who have a very intimate relationship. So you see these different kinds of relationships between between the conversations. I don't know, that I think actually is a testament to the point that you're making, like to take the writers, take their work on their terms, as opposed to, well, don't you think, you know, because she could have easily intervened and said, well, do you think that, you know, Gwendolyn Brooks was competing with you? Or, you know, she said, you know, I mean, then that's not the posture. They sort of stand as these kind of, you know, pieces in conversation, but not in contestation, I guess. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm thinking of the Alexis DeVoe, if I'm pronouncing her last name correctly, interview as well, where she says something really revealing, because she is a Black lesbian writing about Black lesbian experiences, and she talks about how it's easier to place her work with non-Black journals, that Black journals at the time when she's trying to place work talk about her work like undermining the Black family, like this larger political project, which has like a whole other thing going on there. And Claudia Tate sort of like allows her to just like put all of that out there, that like very painful trying to like parse through thing, and doesn't necessarily like comment on it, but allows her enough space to like give, I think, like a pretty good context of like why in that particular moment that would have been happening. And I think about that moment a lot too, because it's so fascinating and interesting to me, and for me checks, I think, some like rose-colored glasses on some sort of like Black arts past that I think oftentimes, I know if you didn't live through it, you can often feel about that time, because so much was done, there was so much energy, all these sorts of things. But also, it was a political project, which means some stories were adamantly like not allowed in, and some stories were allowed in, you know? And so like that, those sorts of things complicate, I think, too, what particularly I think is a trap for marginalized writers, is to look at communities in the past and really sort of like idolize them and assume that there weren't those divisions, really like rough divisions and revisions that did exist then. And I think having to grapple with that helps us try to figure out like in our current moment how to do that as well.
Especially since so many of, and that's a question that is still with us. I mean, it's still, mm-hmm. I mean, it's less crudely stated.
Yeah.
But the kind of, you know, variety, queer antagonism is still a recurrent theme in, mm-hmm. you know, Black creative communities, without question. I've been thinking a lot about how they talk, many of the writers talk about gender in Black communities, and it's really fascinating too, because it also is really a kind of, I think it's a nuanced conversation, but people don't have the same sort of interpretations. Like there's this, and I could go to the text, but there's this sort of, several of them write about, okay, so often Black male writers, they're writing about a kind of confrontation with society, like the sort of structural forces. Mm-hmm. And writers are more likely to be writing about kind of the interior, and, you know, which is sort of like long tradition, but then, you know, the distinction that Morrison is sort of doing both at once. And then Sonia Sanchez chimes in and says, well, but if you talk about the poets, there isn't that clear gender distinction, right?
Yeah.
And so even that conversation pushes against, I think, our tendency to read like sensibilities of a time period in a simplistic way.
Mm-hmm.
You see that so much, like sort of people did this in this period and people thought this in this period. And there's actually a wide range of the ways that people were experiencing, even in the midst of the sort of blooming of Black women's literature, what people were experiencing it as substantively varied.
Yeah. You were talking a little bit about like the interiority of how much sort of Black women fiction writers in particular, like, interested in interiority. And this morning for another project, I interviewed Colleen Smith, who made the movie Dry Long So that came out in the 90s. Yeah, and it's getting a restoration by Criterion. It looks gorgeous. I hope it's going to come out soon. But I was interviewing her this morning, and she, and if you don't know that movie, it came out in 1998. It had a sort of like, was really praised when it first came out, but of course it's like in this period of time where distribution is really difficult. There's no streaming. She worked really hard to get it onto video cassette. And then a year later, DVDs were all the rage. So it like never really took off. But it's about a young Black girl in Oakland in the late 90s. And she's doing this art project where she's taking Polaroids of the Black men in her neighborhood because she's worried that they are going to go extinct because they're sort of like, they're living under this sort of like oppressive violence. There's all these killings happening around them, and it's beautifully shot, absolutely beautifully shot. Anyways, And the movie itself, this is where it comes ties with this. The movie itself, the plot is a mixture. One of the reasons why she's had trouble finding distribution is because the plot is a mixture of like a coming of age story, but it's also a thriller, but it's also like a deeply strange art piece. Like it's a mixture of all things at once. And she was talking about how much she relates that to Black women's interiority does not follow these sort of like storytelling conventions that much of art does. And so that's like an additional like way that your work can often be misinterpreted, because our narratives often don't fit any sort of like boxes or an amalgamation of all of that. And so oftentimes they're sort of misread or just like not able to be categorized. And because it's not able to be categorized, of course it can't be sold. And so then it doesn't really have like a larger sort of like value, quote unquote, in like this art marketplace that we have. But that's sort of like a hallmark of many people's ways of mining Black women's interiority, is like this inability to be within a particular category. And I just, her words really, because I think a lot too about how many of these artists in this book worked across disciplines. Yeah. You had poets who felt really comfortable attempting to write novels. You had novelists, you had like Toni Cade Bambara is an excellent example, a novelist who also became a filmmaker and like felt really comfortable switching mediums. This interdisciplinary way of attacking the artistic impulse that I think feeds into attempting to explain the interiority of Black womanhood in like a really specific way that I think all of these writers are getting at least a little bit in these conversations.
I think that's so true. And it, for me, I think this, I just sort of realized this, but I think this book is a part of, you know, for me, so much of my sense of life mission is to insist that people understand Black women artists are also intellectuals, and, mm-hmm. and that, you know, so often there's that sort of division into, you know, genre or sort of category actually serves to erase a large part of the intellectual work that goes behind artistic production and the way in which people move across these categories. And it also made me think about, and I'm just thinking about this mostly for the people watching, because it just occurred to me that dryloxo is a word that's actually no longer in popular parlance. And, you know, that it is a word, you know, a word from Black English that is sort of like, you know, how Gwendolyn Brooks said, living in the along, it's like sort of the everyday, like the way you go. And that is the way, you know, you live these questions, right? And they're part of the everyday, and you move through them. And that's a piece of why, you know, you look for different modes of expression, right? And this is, you know, there's all these testaments to them. And then it's not just different, looking for different modes of expression and wanting to get them out, but actually thinking deeply and working on making sort of artifacts or pieces that become these vehicles for us to, you know, contemplate the questions or the ideas in the long term.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, when it's so funny, because when I first was reading about that movie, I was like, I know that word. I've seen that word so often growing up. I know that word. And then realizing like I hadn't heard that word in like 20 years, I was like...
Words like that, it's like, you know, like britches, people don't say britches anymore
either. Yeah, that's true. We still say britches in my house, but
you do? Okay.
Yeah, slacks, oh my god, tennis shoes, all those.
Yeah, tennis shoes. Old-fashioned words. Yeah, but
If you're enjoying the Haymarket Live series, you'll also be interested in a new book from Haymarket, Angela Davis, An Autobiography. Featuring a substantial new introduction by the author, Angela Davis, An Autobiography, is a classic account of a life in struggle. Angela Davis has been a political activist at the cutting edge of the Black liberation, feminist, queer, and prison abolitionist movements for more than 50 years. First published and edited by Toni Morrison in 1974, Angela Davis, An Autobiography, is a powerful and commanding account of her early years of political activity. With warmth, brilliance, humor, and conviction, Davis describes her journey from a childhood on Dynamite Hill in Birmingham, Alabama, to one of the most significant political trials of the century. From her political activity in a New York high school, to her work with the U.S. Communist Party, the Black Panther Party, and the Soledad Brothers. And from the faculty of the philosophy department at UCLA, to the FBI's list of the 10 most wanted fugitives. Find Angela Davis, An Autobiography, at haymarketbooks.org.
I'm wondering if you can talk, a little bit about if there's any writers who are included in here who you feel like are ripe for a rediscovery. Like, there's the names that I think everybody would recognize on the front, like Audre Lorde and all these people, but are there any sort of like overlooked writers who you're excited for people to discover when they read this book?
Well, always Gail Jones, because mm-hmm. I'm obsessed with Gail Jones and I wrote a profile of her, but I still feel as though, because so much of her work was published in relatively obscure, small, you know, so she has novels that are out, and then Palmares just came out, and I keep losing language because I just two months out of COVID. But there's all these beautiful short pieces that are ripe for people to sort of rediscover. And her, in the interview, her real sort of deliberateness in how she talks about the relationship between everyday language and craft is really important, especially because, you know, so with Jones, people like, you know, Toni Morrison and June Jordan and Maya Angelou were all like, okay, she's transformed Black women's writing. And but really, unless you're in an academic program where you're studying Black women's literature or African American literature in the late 20th century, you're not likely to encounter Gail Jones, frankly. I mean, she's largely a writer that you encounter in formal education. Maybe that's true. Yeah. So I'm thinking that maybe people will be intrigued by this discussion and sort of be, you know, want to read more of her work and, you know, chase down her short fiction, her critical essays. She was also a scholar, like person, so many of the others here. And then also Shirley Ann Williams, who I think, you know, so hers is the final interview. And I don't know if I've sort of even I have read anything that talks about Shirley Ann Williams' work in the past 20 years. And she wrote, you know, Dessa Rose, which I think is one of the most powerful, you know, novels about slavery, but also about sort of the question of love in the context of being enslaved and how people pursued it and how people created conceptions of the self and Black women in particular in that. And so, yeah, I think both of them, but really everybody. I think there's the re-encounter that with Audre Lorde that can happen through this interview, because she's sort of the memeified hero. And this is, you know, she's really reflective here. Gwendolyn Brooks, who is so historically significant, but who I think is sort of fallen out of favor. There's a great new documentary about Nikki Giovanni that I think this interview is like a great entry point to wanting to see that too, which is...
Oh, wonderful. I didn't know there was a doc by her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. I guess. Oh, and I also wanted to say too, if you are watching, we please questions from the audience as well. We would love to hear from or what you're thinking or that sort of thing as well. Let's see.
I can ask you a question.
Oh, I'm asking a lot.
I'm curious about there's sort of I guess this question about politics and writing that appears in multiple places here, and even like Sonia Sanchez has this part where she talks about you know, there was this decision by some people in African American studies to distance themselves from the movement. And I'm wondering if you think that it all resonates with questions today about the literary and the political, and sort of if there's something for us to learn from them about, you know, how to navigate those questions, right? Of both art, but also the urgency of the moment. In some ways we are in a comparably urgent moment, although a distinct one, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's a reminder that like the idea that you as a Black woman writer are inherently, that your work is inherently activism is a fallacy, I think, that is very easy to fall into. And I think these writers here, because of the particular political moment that they were writing in and the particular circles that they ran in, like understood perhaps better than many of us do the distinctions between actual aims. and I think, I don't know, I feel like it's very easy to sort of slip into, I'm always a pessimist, so I feel like it's really easy for writers today to slip into sort of like self-congratulatory, like, to write is enough, or somehow to write is doing the work, when it's not. Like, they're not the same thing at all. Like, what you're doing as a writer and the intricacies of making a book and publishing it have nothing to do with political organizing work, and they're not the same thing, and they don't have the same impact, and that is okay. And the sooner that we can like understand that and stop subbing one in for the other, like the further we can get. Because I think it's really, it stops the, right now we're in a really weird place where, sort of like elevating the writer as somehow political actually like stops the political conversation in like a really weird way, where it's like, it's just enough to write the screenplay or, you know, write a poem about this. And it is not and never will be.
I mean, it's interesting because in some ways, because Sanchez raises this point where she's saying, well, some of how the writers get elevated in order to detract attention away from liberation movements. So she identifies liberation movements all over the world. And in some ways that's still true, right? So that if we as writers say, okay, well, this is our activism, and then there people are talking about us as writers, and this is our activism, while there's a lot of activism that actually takes up space.
Yeah, and it's collaborative in a way that writing never is. Writing is intensely about the self.
Yes.
And activism cannot be, by definition, intensely about the self.
You know? Actually, kind of, you know, you have to mute the self in order to be in community with people who may think very differently, but you're trying to get free, collectively. Absolutely. Yeah. Should we take some of these questions?
Yeah. Somebody asked, can you elaborate more on this crisis of literary criticism? Is this a crisis in the academy or literary criticism in current literary magazines or larger online cultural magazines? I was talking more about larger, like, I guess, like mainstream publication criticism, I think. Part of that is just the death of newspapers. We actually don't have book reviews really anymore. And because of the politics of book reviews, most of the books that are getting reviewed, you get a description of what the plot is, and then you either get this was fantastic and, you know, the second coming of James Baldwin,
right.
Or very, very rarely you will get like a really mean pan. But there's nothing in between because people will click on either one of those extremes. But people will not click on let me do like a measured understanding of the themes of this and taking it on the writer's terms and threading it into a larger history of what it may be in conversation with. That's not going to get a click.
Yeah.
So because those are the economics under which literary criticism is currently being produced, we don't have those sort of like, or the spaces to have those longer discussions about literature are very rare. And we don't, you know, alternative newspapers died 2015 or 20 years ago. It used to be that you had something like the Village Voice or, you know, and other of these spaces, regional and alternative newspapers where people would have these discussions on pages over years. You know, people would be writing dueling columns back and forth, working this out, maybe not working this out, but having a public conversation. And that simply doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
So I think we've lost a lot of that, and our current spaces where we could have that are engineered by people who are not writers, who are, you know, like tech enthusiasts. And they have created those spaces to reward sort of like the easiest, simplest, most enthusiastic or most revolted take on a piece of work, which means the actual work of criticism, it suffers, in my opinion.
I think that's right. And I just something that you said, which just I was like, you know, ding, ding. I wanted to like ring a bell is the sort of the second coming of James Baldwin formulation, right? But it's also this. That it's like every writer, if they're, you know, it's either this is Toni Morrison or this is James Baldwin. And mm-hmm. part of what's so, I think, important about the reissue of this book is that it's a reminder that they had contemporaries, many stuff, right? Like that it's not, it obviously people should be treated as, you know, writers on their own terms doing what they're doing, but also that there's always been this kind of robust Black intellectual artistic community that's operating with distinctions that need to be recognized in the genealogy of how we write about people, right? Like, so one of the things I do when I interview, I'm almost always asking people, like, who are the writers who have shaped and influenced you? And invariably, they include people who don't get cited all the time in the major publications.
Yep. Yeah, 100%. And like, you know, I was a huge nerd as a teenager. So that's actually how I learned about writing was reading The Village Voice, reading the Boston Arts Papers, Salon was when it was like a literary site way back in the late 90s.
Right.
I was the nerd who read that and I bought they put out like a one of those, like, it was like an encyclopedia of all living writers or something. I think it came out like 1998 or 1999. I got it in high school. And I would just go through there and just read all of the writers' side. And it was famous people like Salman Rushdie. And then it was like lesser known writers or whatever. And it was an infographic, you know, totally according to the taste of whoever the Salon editor was. So like a little bit wonky, but whatever. It was a place to start.
Yes.
And it was like a place to understand and to understand that you could follow connections from artists to writers and also to just make myself this reading list. And I think those spaces, I don't know that they're more difficult to find, but I think they're just more difficult to find. I don't think they don't exist, but I think it's just a little bit more difficult to find those spaces. And definitely if you don't already know that they exist, it's like that much harder to get them because what used to happen was you're walking home from school and you pass a, you know, newspaper box and you're waiting for the train and you just grab it to read it.
Yes.
That doesn't happen when your algorithm is a For You page that has already decided everything that you may possibly be interested in, you know what I mean? So
it's so funny. As you said that, I was thinking, I just remembered the first piece, because my first book was about hip hop. The first piece of hip hop criticism I ever read was in The Village Voice.
Yeah.
15 years old. And I was like, oh, you can write about this?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was it. Yeah.
Yeah. This question is from, let's see. Janine DeNovis asks, as Black women writing today, what does the community of Black women writing, ones in this book and other books and ones in real life, afford you or offer you?
Oh. Gosh. I mean, it's for lack of a better word for me, it's breath, in the sense that, you know, it's a sort of the there is something about, and this sounds really basic, but I think it's huge, about being recognized fully as a human being and as a precondition to actually, for me to be in writing community, and that is not exclusively, but often much more accessible in a community of Black women writers, right? So that we don't come to the conversation, and this is evidenced in the book, assuming that we have the same priorities or trying to tell the same story, are assumed to have a kind of two-dimension, like the fullness of what you're undertaking is one piece. And then the other piece is like, and also the constraints, right? The limitations, the responsibilities, the, you know, the ailments, all of those things simultaneously. I like being in a community of writers who I don't have to worry about whether they presume that there is some kind of deficiency inside me or that they know my story. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of what, and that, you know, so I think it's evident in the book, but also in who I talk to as I'm writing. Yeah. What about you?
I think for me, it's like twofold. It's a community of which to ask craft questions to around, to understand the limits and places where my own writing or understanding might be responding to a white gaze or white criticism or internalized anti-Blackness, all those things. It's just good to have somebody to check that against, because we all have that inside us. We, you know, live in this larger culture that tells us these things, and even if you read and surround yourself with all these sorts of things, like, those things come up.
Oh, always, yeah.
So it's really great to just have other people to read and to talk about those things with. And then, like, in the business of being a writer, you know, someone to just be able to understand some of these, like, you know, larger, I guess we would call them today, like, microaggressions, but also just, like, what it is to make a living doing this thing that it can be difficult and can be really hard. And then that other question that is like, what do you owe to your community, which is a question that is, I think it's actually a real privilege that we as Black writers get asked that question much more than white writers do. I actually think it's because I think it's a fantastic, I think everybody should be asked that question, actually. Absolutely. Personally, I don't see it as in like an insult. I think that's a fantastic question to ask any writer, and I wish more white writers were asked that question. I think it's a question that for whoever you are has an evolving answer. And it's a question to like continually check into, and it doesn't always dictate what you're writing. It's not always the like moral compass or guiding North Star, but it is a useful question to have in your pack of questions to ask yourself as a person in the world and as a writer. So yeah, I think having that conversation is really helpful.
Something that you just said made me think of this question that I'm always or like talking point that is always frustrating me, that really, you know, that what you said just resonates deeply with this. So sometimes people ask questions and they will say, and it's usually white people who will say this, like, I know this wasn't written for me, but, and I'm always like, why do you think, like, the writing is for everybody, right? Mm-hmm. The concerns may be particularly with Blackness, but it's not that I'm not writing for you, but I am writing right with a particular set of experiences and history that animates the that animates the work. And I do think that, you know, what you just said about sort of checking in with community of writers, but also thinking about responsibility, right? Writing. So when I say like writing for Black people doesn't mean only writing to Black people, but actually for like Black people in terms of the larger sort of questions of community and responsibility. Yeah.
Cause like for me, the question of like your responsibility to your community is like another way of thinking like, what are the things in my community that I want to write about that I'm noticing are a thing which my community is struggling with, thinking about, testing, whatever. And that is a question that no matter what your race or gender or sexual orientation is going to be pretty pressing if you're an artist, because like that's the bread and butter of what you're doing as an artist. You're trying to see the things that other people won't see, can't see, refuse to see, don't want to talk about. So that's how I interpret that question, and that's how I find that question really helpful. Someone, I just want to address really quickly, someone asked about resources if you are a Black fiction screenwriter outside of formal education. If you can, through your library or through your university, if you can get a subscription to both Canopy and to Criterion Collection. Criterion Collection actually is like working really hard to get a lot of Black independent films onto there, both shorts and feature length and from across the world. If you can follow Ashley Clark on Twitter, and I think he has a Substack too. He works for Criterion. He writes extensively about Black film. Criterion also puts out regularly essays from people on different Black films. They're like a fantastic research resource. I'm not like a shill for them, I promise, but they I do want to give them props for like what they've tried to do. They heard the criticism that their catalog was very, very white, and like they are actively trying to really find like fantastic films. They just added more to their Afrofuturism collection. They just did a really wonderful thing around jazz on film. They have a great hip hop film collection. Just like they're a great resource, and most university libraries, if you can get them that into there somehow, get that email, we'll have a subscription to them. Mm-hmm. Yai asks, if writing is to both labor and craft, what conditions can we create or call in to reinforce the ability of writers to thrive and produce work?
I will say one thing that is really, for me, sort of a drum that I think I'm going to beat for the rest of my life, because I have never I've never been on a writer's retreat, like a sort of formal one, is that it is really important to create child-friendly writing retreat.
Yes.
You know, just like a lot of people don't have a life condition where they can go away for 3 weeks without kids. And mm-hmm. It is such a kind of, it's not just, I mean, it's gendered, but it's also classed. This idea, you know, sort of think about experimentally, how do you have, can you have spaces where there's community childcare? Can you have spaces where people go away for a succession of weekends? I think things like that, and funding, and not just funding when you're at the point, at the precipice of sort of some kind of recognition, but actually funding for people to be experimental, to explore, to try different forms. For me, that would have such a huge impact on the world of writing and art in general, if there was just more space for, and community space, right? Open studio craft writing spaces on weekends where everybody can just be there, and there's, you know, people can use computers, and there's canvases, and the kids can run around, and there's food, like those kind of spaces, which I feel like were sort of imagined and hoped for, that did not, for a previous, you know, for previous generations, that we either have not sustained or not been able to create. Those are the kind of things I think we really do need.
Yeah, 100%. And I'll just go along with that. In addition to like having those spaces, luckily, I think places have stopped asking for this as much, because I think during the pandemic, people said it was too much. But The idea, especially as Black artists, oftentimes fellowships for us are attached to community work or to teaching work. And oftentimes you're asked to sort of like do this really intense community work that leaves no time for your own creative work. And you're essentially just like a teaching artist being brought in. And that model can kind of work maybe for visual artists, maybe for spoken word. It does not work for like fiction writers. It does not work really for poets. It does not really work for scholars. Teaching workshops is its own skill set that not every writer has and not every writer should have. And oftentimes, especially when you are a Black writer, the assumption is that you can come in and like teach a writing workshop to five-year-olds. I've done that. I enjoy doing that. I'm good at that. But that's because I've done that since I was like 15 years old. So I've been like, I have like 25 years of training. That's why I'm able to do that. But if you do not have that and are not inclined to do that, you shouldn't be asked to do that to get a $5,000 grant to be able to do your work. So I'm happy to see like the trend in literary circles. There's people are starting to like understand that and decouple from that. And we just need to keep that energy going. Cause I see it all the time where they're like, here's this grant. And you're like, great. And it's like, you're agreeing to teach for 35 hours. Like, crazy, like whatever. It's like, no, please.
What's the point? Yeah. Yeah. Question that Janica asked about the relation, the interdisciplinary impulse. She asked, you spoke about the interdisciplinary impulse. I'm deeply interested in the relationship between Black women writers and visual artists. Are there any visual artists that inspire you? And I will just say, both Leslie Sarr and Sonia Clark in recent years have been deeply inspirational to me in terms of thinking about gender and embodiment and history and the relationship between our body, how our bodies exist in the world and have moved through time and ideas. So I, visual artists, and also Toyin Oji Odutola, like there's a lot of our visual artists who provide direct inspiration to me.
Yeah, 100%. Faith Rangel, Carrie James Marshall, so many visual artists. And that is, I will say, if you are a writer in here and you're like at a stop for inspiration or you need something to like reset your mind, familiarizing yourself with that work by, you know, Black visual artist is so key, so important. I can't tell you the number of times where I'll be stuck with a scene and then I see like a Carrie James Marshall image or another image and it just makes me rethink things or feel like I can sort of like get stuff. So following all of that is like part of my artistic practice and I think is like can be a really fruitful way to make sure that your work is constantly overturning itself, I guess.
There was, in fact, in a book that I wrote on gender theory, it was Julie Moretti's paintings, mm-hmm. maps that actually gave me sort of the way that I would, it gave me the path to how I was going to talk about remapping mm-hmm. gender relations, right? Mm-hmm. It was just sort of sitting in front of the pieces
Yeah, and then, you know, like so many Black visual artists, their work is beautifully narrative. Like I'm thinking like Carrie Mae Weems, like just really evocative and feel like they are stills from a film or feel like they're from, you know, some documentary project or something. And so that's always really generative too, so.
Great. I think that we're out of time. We're going all night.
You're coming up, and these are beautiful questions. Thank you, everybody.
They are. And I just want to just say, as I always say, Caitlin, I really so deeply appreciate your work, and I still am always in disbelief that you're no longer the baby in the carriage, and you're this incredibly brilliant, beautiful writer, thinker, and so it's just a joy to talk to you.
Yeah, everyone should know, Imani has known me since I was literally in diapers, so... She was not much older, but she's definitely seen me sitting in a stroller, drooling away. So look how far I've come.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.